From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, in honor of Minority Mental Health Month, we hear one man's struggle with mental illness and his advice for others. Then we learn about a Milwaukee County program that aims to help people facing eviction.
When you think about the $10 million, that's only going to give us the ability to help about 2,000 families. This can have an impact for up to 60,000 families. And so this is going to be an issue of resources, and we just need to make sure that we can take care of our folks.
Plus, a local COVID-19 survivor shares her story to help this global pandemic feel a little more personal.
Those little things, they have a ripple effect, and I think the more we can do better by each other, the better off we're going to be during this pandemic and the stronger communities we're going to have.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Minority Mental Health Awareness Month has been observed each July since 2008. Formerly known as B.B. Moore Campbell National Minority Health Awareness Month, it honors the late American author, journalist, and teacher B.B. Moore Campbell. Her work was centered on bringing awareness to the unique struggles that underrepresented groups face regarding mental illness. In recognition of Minority Mental Health Awareness Month, we hear from Milwaukee native Benny Perez Reyes, principal owner of Clover Phoenix Capital, which helps fund businesses in the Milwaukee area. He's also a suicide survivor, so we would like to warn listeners that this interview may include language that is disturbing to some. Perez Reyes shares his personal decade-long journey with mental health. He opens up the conversation with why it's important for everybody, no matter who they are, to be vigilant about their mental health.
We all go through peaks and valleys of life, and each of us cope with those peaks and valleys in different ways. Others are affected tremendously by it, and others are able to, quote unquote, move on with life. Where I would caution is what that moving on looks like. You have to have a barometer of where your mental health is at. And I think instead of it being something taboo, right, we ought to be able to have conversations, normalize conversations about mental health. And it can take on different ways, right? Whether that be seeing a professional or just having a good friend that you're able to bounce ideas off and seek good advice. But that's also, you know, it also comes to the point where you need to be able as an individual discern, hey, do I have the ability to talk to a friend or do I need to take it up a notch and talk to somebody, right? An objective third party that doesn't know me, doesn't know my background on how to get that right. The same way, hey, you know, if it's a health thing, hey, you know what? I might need to gain some weight. I might to lose some weight. I might need to see a doctor. I'm not feeling great. Just the way that we normalize those traditional medical services, I think when it comes to mental health, we ought to be able to do so. And for some people, it may not be a medical, right? It might be a spiritual awakening for them. It was for me. So, you know, for me, and I say that with a profound amount of humility, for everybody, it looks different and it's okay for it to be different.
Where we're at in your story right now is you are out of college, you have a job, you've moved on from retail, so it might look like you're kind of like on the up and up, right? But there seems to be this deep satisfaction in your life at this point as a young adult. So take it from there.
For me, there was a lack of fulfillment, right? Something wasn't enough, right? This perception of who I was supposed to be and who I am didn't mesh. And it wasn't this constance of being in a place, a dark place all the time, right? Again, peaks and valleys. So I would ebb in and out of depression, anxiety, and, you know, all that stuff that came with it. You know, that comes to a head in 2019, September of 2019, I'm navigating working a job with helping another business as well as starting my own. And so there's a lot coming at me, right? I mentioned I'm also a father, and then just being real, right? The effects of all of that, mental health wise, starting your own business, focusing on other things at that time has an effect on the relationship that I had all throughout undergrad as well as up to that point. It came to a head where, you know, I decided, hey, you know, this is something that I'm struggling with, and I no longer want to struggle. Right. It got down to making a decision that I no longer wanted to be around. I was going through something, and it just became so taxing that seeking that choice became almost a natural consequence of everything. As sad as that may be, right? And I say that with a profound amount of humility, because it happens to many people, right? And people leave not understanding why somebody would make such a drastic decision. But in that moment, that clarity isn't reality, right? They're living a different reality than the one that we would consider normal or healthy.
Benny, did you try to kill yourself?
I did.
What do you think when you reflect on that?
This episode that we're talking about, you know, didn't happen very long ago for me. It happened in September of 2019, end of September 2019. Faith-based spirituality, for me, that has been a tremendous way of understanding myself in a different way, of reflecting, of meditating on who Benny was and who Benny is right now. I don't even consider myself the same person. Once I felt that change, it was almost as if I was looking at my life from a helicopter and looking down upon it and saying, ah, that's how all these dots were connected. That's what led to all of this. And taking responsibility, right? Taking responsibility and onus behind those decisions.
What do you say to people who might be hearing this and are in a dark place or who do struggle with suicidal thoughts?
One, you know, you're loved, right? Your life is incredibly important, that you are valuable. You know, the parts of yourself that you believe to be true, you have a name. You're not called by the mistakes that you make, right? You're not defined by the choices that you've made in the past. You know, the failures that you may define as being who you are, none of that is relevant, right? That the start to any journey begins with a single step, and that you can make that choice today, if you so choose. And what awaits you is something much more beautiful than what you're going through now. But that you're not alone, right? That you're not alone, and there are ways for you to get help, and there's no shame in any of the ways that you choose to get help. But make sure that they're good, right? They're good enough themselves, and use your ability to decide what good is for you. Whether that's exercise, whether that's therapy in its various iterations, whether it's medical, whether it's medication, whatever it is that you need, that you know that you need, or that somebody's helping you to know that you need, take that with a profound amount of humility and do the best thing that you can do for yourself and the others that are around you. But it has to be about you first. You have to take care of yourself first. It has to be about you.
Benny, what is one thing that you want people who hear this conversation to walk away with?
I think it's important to discern when people are asking for help versus communicating what they've been going through. Those are two very different things. And I say that as somebody who's very transparent about my walk, because I want people to know that, hey, there are other people that you may not know. That strong friend that you have that's always strong, yeah, they may be going through mental health stuff, right? And it's okay to check on them. And it's okay to ask them questions and concern yourself with them. And likewise, that strong friend, it's okay to tell people that you're not okay, right? It's too normal, right, for us to say, oh, hi, how are you doing? And the natural response is, oh, I'm fine, I'm good, right? Well, that's complete BS, right? And we know it, right? Because we can see it, right? Or we feel it, right? So latching onto that. So I think one of the things that I want to make sure is that people understand that it's okay to not be okay, and that to discern, hey, when is it somebody who's asking me for help? And then when is it just okay for me to just listen and be a sounding board for somebody? Sometimes we don't need somebody to fix us. We just need somebody to hear us and listen without the need to write. God gave us two ears, one mouth. There's a reason for that.
As I listen to your story, is like, are you comfortable? And it's okay, I want you to be totally honest. Are you comfortable if I refer to you as a survivor?
Sure.
I think it's incredibly powerful that it also goes along with your title of I'm a principal owner at Clover Phoenix Capital and a survivor of suicide, because I feel like that totally reframes this stigma of like, it's just people who are like down and out, like don't have anything going for them in their lives, you know, who struggle with this. I think it's like, no, this also affects, like, just, you just said, like the strong friend, right? The person who looks like they have a lot of things going on for them. And that's why we need to normalize this and have this as part of our conversations. So I just, that was what was coming to me when you were telling me your story, but I wanted to check in with you and see if that's something that you're okay with and you're comfortable with.
It's not something that I lead with, but I definitely think it's one of the quote unquote titles that define me, right? And I think, as you mentioned, right, what does somebody who's going through mental health look like? Like, right, it doesn't exist, right? It doesn't exist, right? And we need not define it by characteristics, although there are, right, telltale signs. We're people, right? People go through mental health, and it doesn't matter who you are, what you look like, what your racial makeup, what your genetic makeup is, gender, none of that, religious, spiritual, none of that, right? We all, as I mentioned, go through peaks and valleys of life.
Benny Perez Reyes, Milwaukee native, principal owner of Clover Phoenix Capital and suicide survivor. Thank you so much for joining me, for sharing with me your story, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
That was WUWM's Angelina Mosher Salazar speaking with Benny Perez Reyes. If you or someone you know is in need of mental health assistance, you can find resources by calling 211. After the break, we learn about resources for people facing eviction in Milwaukee County. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. When the state of Wisconsin first announced safer at home orders in March, it also ordered a temporary ban on evictions and foreclosures. Unlike the pandemic, the order was limited to a 60-day period, which ended in May. Now, as COVID-19 infections are spiking, so too are evictions. Eviction filings jumped more than 40% statewide in June compared to last year. This story of economic turmoil followed by an eviction and housing crisis is familiar to Milwaukeeans, who seem uniquely vulnerable to these problems. Here in Milwaukee County, officials have created programs to help residents facing eviction. Milwaukee County Executive David Crowley and Milwaukee County Housing Division Administrator Jim Matthey joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about these issues and the possible solutions.
David Crowley, James Matthey, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So, as both of you know, we are looking at a looming eviction crisis. And already evictions in Milwaukee County are up 40%, more than 40% compared to last year. What are some of the things that are factoring into this current crisis that we're seeing here in Milwaukee County?
I think that's an excellent question, and thank you for asking. When we think about this crisis related to housing, I mean, it's definitely something that is not new across the country. And particularly here, we've always seen it as a big issue. When you think about how many women have really faced evictions and how many men have been locked up. If you've read the book Evicted, this is actually talked about. But right now, what we've seen is that the COVID-19 has really had a huge impact on many different communities, but in particular, communities of color here in Milwaukee County. And so many people have lost their jobs because of COVID-19. A lot of people have not been able to receive their unemployment checks up until this point. And so we know that this is definitely contributing to the amount of evictions that we have seen since the moratorium was lifted back in May. So we're doing everything that we can to mitigate this issue, to provide some housing assistance.
Yet, why are people in Milwaukee County seemingly uniquely vulnerable to eviction? I think these are numbers actually from you. 60,000 people are projected to be impacted by this crisis, which is four times the annual rate. Is that right?
That is right. That is correct. About four times compared to what we see on a standard annual rate. At the end of the day, I mean, we have issues. And when we think about not only just COVID-19, but the other pandemic, which is racism, it has contributed to many different factors. When we talk about education, when we talk about incarceration, but also when we talk about housing. One of the biggest issues, and when you think about the income gap between white people and black people here in the city of Milwaukee, Milwaukee County, and across the state, on average, if I'm not mistaken, Wisconsin currently ranks at the second from the bottom when you think about the disparities. And so we have to do better. I think our white counterparts make two times as much as our black counterparts here in the state of Wisconsin. So we definitely believe that it is an income issue. But it's really about making sure that people have access to as many self-sustaining, family-sustaining jobs as possible.
Now, we're going to go into some of the solutions that you have come up with for this current crisis. But I was curious, looking at just the numbers here, how does Wisconsin compare to the rest of the country, specifically as we're looking at tenant rights? Because that seems to be a big part of this conversation.
So it's a very important part of this conversation. I think we're in a unique position right now with the eviction program that we're working on. There's widespread support for the Milwaukee County's CARES Act allocations for housing programs. This is a program where the tenants obviously need it. The court commissioners are very excited about it, but also our landlords are very interested. A lot of the landlords that we have used in our division, good high quality landlords, obviously haven't been able to collect rent on a lot of those individuals. And we have a lot of landlords that are holding off on evictions, which is great. We're partnering with the apartment associations. So we have a lot of landlords that are holding off on evictions, which is good. And they're very interested in this program as well. So it's one of these unique opportunities where we're able to assist not just the tenants and the clients that we serve, but also landlords as well.
I guess the question that I was trying to ask there is, how do the rights for tenants in the state of Wisconsin, Milwaukee County, how does that compare to what we see in other parts of the country? Are tenants here more vulnerable to eviction in some ways, or do the laws really match up to what we see in other states, other counties?
I think for the most part, it's fairly consistent. When you look state to state, as County Executive Crowley mentioned, Milwaukee just has some unfortunate, unique challenges, especially when it comes to racism, as well as a lot of our individuals are low income. Our poverty rates are higher in Milwaukee than many other cities. So I think the laws across the country are fairly similar. We just have some unique challenges here to tackle locally.
So let's get into some of these solutions. Last week, the county announced a $10 million investment meant to stem this crisis. What does that $10 million get us? What does that pay for?
Well, that $10 million is going to, you know, is barely going to scratch the surface when you think about the eviction crisis that we have seen. So this gives us an opportunity to do what we can for those who have been affected by the COVID-19, but also to make sure that we're focusing on racial equity in our long-term strategy. So $7 million of that $10 million will go directly towards rent assistance programs. And we have a partnership with community advocates, and we will provide up to about $3,000 in a landlord-tenant, basically like a stipend, through a stipulated agreement to make sure that people are not being evicted from their homes. About $2 million will go towards housing acquisition efforts, which will basically give Milwaukee County the ability to purchase additional facilities to house individuals in need. And this is also for, you know, long-term solutions that we're looking at and making sure that we can end chronic homelessness as well. But also putting $1 million towards mortgage assistance efforts for those who, you know, who are facing economic challenges as well. And so this is a three-part approach to what we're trying to do. Again, it's only $10 million. We hope that, you know, we can continue to talk to our federal legislators, state electeds as well, to bring the much needed resources that we need.
When I'm looking at the notes that were sent over to me, one of the other things that was mentioned is, and I'm quoting this, placing staff from the housing division or from community partners in the Zoom courtroom during eviction proceedings, helping families face eviction, access the resources they need to prevent eviction and housing insecurity, end quote. Why is that important?
Sure. So I can touch on that. So one of the things we wanted to be able to do with our CARES Act money is act very quickly. So once the eviction moratorium ended, as these programs get off the ground, there were households already literally being evicted. So we wanted to be able to get to those families as quickly as possible. So we've been in several conversations with the court commissioners, and again, with a program that will benefit tenants and landlords being able to be in those eviction hearings with resources in real time would be a really unique opportunity for us to be able to do. So the court commissioners are very excited about that. We're hoping to start that soon. And we already have a list of every single eviction hearing that has been scheduled that hasn't happened yet. So we're already able to call these landlords, call these tenants, and try to work out plans before the eviction even happens. So we're definitely excited to get in as quickly as we can in these court cases.
You know, as you mentioned, there had been an eviction moratorium in part due to, or I believe entirely due to, the pandemic. We're still in the middle of the pandemic, but that moratorium is over. Is there any way of bringing that back? Is that even part of this conversation?
Well, I guess when you think about the rent moratorium, we would love to have that back. But unfortunately, I think that got caught up in the Supreme Court laws that were passed. And so I'm not sure if we're going to see anything like that. But that's why we're putting out that call to action. That call to action is for, you know, Milwaukee County constituents, but also constituents across Wisconsin should be calling their federal official. Local governments need that direct and flexible spending and resources in order to really tackle this pandemic. Milwaukee County still has to deliver many of our services, and many of those services are mandated, or many people rely on these services in order to get by. So it's really about making sure that the federal government and the governor's administration, as well as state legislators, are doing their due diligence to bring us as many resources as back. Because again, when you think about the $10 million, that's only going to give us the ability to help about 2,000 families. And as we stated earlier, this can have an impact for up to 60,000 families. And so this is going to be an issue of resources, and we just need to make sure that we can take care of our folks.
Yeah. You know, you've said 2,000 households, that's 2,000 different families, perhaps. What more do you think can be done at the county level to help solve this issue?
Well, we're doing everything that we can. We're continuously having conversations about what other community support programs that we need to help out. We have to make sure that we're leveraging not only all the dollars that Milwaukee County has received, but all the municipalities here. And so we're going to continue to have those conversations about what we can do. We're looking at not only just housing, but what can we do to provide alternative activities that people can still practice physical distancing for our young people in all of our parks? How do we make sure that people can still come to the Milwaukee County Zoo and feel safe and get to enjoy this outdoor experience? Or whether we're talking about mental health, we talked about social distancing for so long that many people stop socializing with one another. And so I hate the term social distancing, and that's why I say physical distancing, because we need people to socialize with one another. We have a lot of people who have been stuck at home, and being at home is not necessarily the safest place for them. So Milwaukee County is going to continue to be a convener, look at the data and the science as to how we continue to open up and deliver our services to those most in need, and continue to do that. But again, we're going to continue to fight for this community and make sure that we are safe as a people so we can have a safe economy once this pandemic is behind us at some point.
So for people who are perhaps most impacted by these problems, specifically people who are facing down eviction, how do they participate in these programs?
Great question. So they can visit the Community Advocates website, which is communityadvocates.net. You can sign up through there. I think I know the number by heart, which is 414-270-4646. I mean, it's really about making sure that you are calling Milwaukee County, calling Community Advocates, because, again, this is a limited amount of funds. And so we believe that they're going to go fast. So we need to make sure that everybody applies. I can tell you that since Thursday, June 11th, when we first launched this program, within the first week, we received about 900 applications. And so we know that there is a need, and so we're going to continue to fight for that.
David Crowley is the Milwaukee County Executive, and Jim Mathey is the county's Housing Division Administrator. They spoke with Lake Fextroy Powers last month. After the break, we hear from a COVID-19 patient and survivor. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. There are now over 50,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Wisconsin, and over 900 people have died. Over 4 million people in the U.S. have contracted the virus, and 150,000 have died. Back in May, we spoke to a COVID-19 patient when there were less than 1 million cases nationwide. Danielle Nelson is a healthy 37-year-old woman with no pre-existing conditions who was seemingly at a low risk for contracting coronavirus. However, what started as chest pain she initially dismissed escalated to getting hospitalized with COVID-19. She joins me now to share her story in the hope that others can learn from her experience as cases continue to climb. Danielle begins by explaining when she initially started feeling unwell.
So I started having chest pain around probably March 12th or 13th, and I didn't really think too much of it because these are crazy times we're living in, and I thought it was just anxiety, and so I kind of shrugged it off. But then on March 16th, I started feeling a little off in the morning, and then by the evening, I had kind of a full-on fever, and so I pretty much did not leave my bed for the next several days until the afternoon of March 19th, when I ended up going to the ER to get tested. It was a really brief visit. They gave me a prescription for albuterol to help with breathing, which at the time I didn't need. So I went home, went immediately back to bed, and then, really kind of took a turn for the worse. And so it got to the point where, it was really hard to walk. I was resisting the urge to crawl, to get around the house. So in the later afternoon of March 24th, I ended up going back to the ER, and then was there until the 29th, and then was back home and have been recovering from home since March 29th.
So before you went to the ER that first time to get tested, were you on the phone with a doctor and the recommendation was to go and get tested? Was it a difficult thing to get testing? Because that is kind of an inconsistent thing right now throughout the country is testing availability.
Yeah, I think maybe for the area, I was maybe ahead of the curve. So, you know, there was no wait in the emergency room. I was in and out in 15 minutes. And I didn't call anyone ahead of time. I just had a feeling. And my fever was kind of all over the place while I was in bed from, you know, it'd be 99 and then it spiked at 104. So I knew that I just really was not well and I shouldn't have a fever for that many days in a row. So I just went to the ER.
Right. And you are, you know, a young, healthy person, no pre-existing conditions, no history of smoking, nothing like that. It was unexpected, right?
Completely. Yeah. I mean, when I look at the list of, you know, folks or conditions that might put me more at risk, I don't meet any of them. And so it was another reason I kind of looked past the chest pain initially, just because I thought, you know, I shouldn't really be at risk. You know, so maybe I could worry a little bit less, but that was obviously my mistake.
Well, there's a lot of information being bombarded at us. So by the time you're admitted into the hospital, and this was before any tests came back positive or negative, correct?
Right.
So what was your experience like to be a COVID patient inside the hospital?
Being in the hospital with COVID was really scary. And really isolating, because as you probably know, no one's allowed into the hospital. And so I was there by myself. And, you know, I've been messaging with someone on Facebook who is in the hospital now with COVID in a different part of the country. And she kind of compared it to being a zoo animal. And when I read that, I choked up because that was really my experience as well. You know, understandably, doctors and nurses are afraid, and I felt that very much so. And just having that limited contact was really scary when you're, you know, spending so much time alone with your thoughts.
So no visitors outside of medical staff coming in to check on you. You're isolated. Medical staff are covered head to toe in PPE. You know, were there certain things they tried to do to help you feel more comfortable and less intimidated, or is everyone just as overwhelmed by everything?
Well, I think because it seems like I was there kind of on the front end of people getting COVID here, there was a lot still being sorted out. And I think folks hadn't quite adjusted to the new normal. And so everyone was so nice to me, of course, and very professional. But you know, just being another human being, I can pick up on people's anxiety. And it's scary and hard to be the diseased one that everyone's afraid of when I'm afraid of myself as well.
Yeah. So how were you feeling, you know, levels of pain and stress physically feeling during the days you're at the hospital? I understand you didn't need a ventilator. You were having some difficulties coughing and those kind of symptoms, but you didn't need to be intubated, fortunately.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm really grateful for that. I did receive oxygen and, you know, I think the thing I'm learning about COVID is that there's really a lot of ups and downs. And that was true for me in the hospital as well. I'd have, you know, times where I just, you know, I couldn't even make it to the bathroom by myself without calling someone in to help me. And I really wasn't able to eat. And, you know, and then, you know, of course, being in the hospital, it's hard to sleep anyway, but, you know, having difficulty sleeping. But then, of course, there were moments that were a little bit easier. And certainly, you know, by the end, I felt like, you know, I was ready to go home, even though I wasn't even sure I was ready to go home. I was scared to go home. And even now being at home, there's good days and bad days still.
Were there any misconceptions about the disease that you had that made you maybe waiting for certain things to happen to you or feel while you were in the hospital because you heard of other people going through it and it was kind of in those initial stages?
Yeah, well, because, you know, it started out just as some chest pain, and then it was kind of just a fever, And then it was a sore throat. You know, I kept worrying that it was going to get worse and worse and that I would end up on a ventilator. And so, because so many people do, and you hear about the shortages of ventilators. And so I'm really just so grateful that I ended up not having to get to that point, but definitely those thoughts were the ones that were keeping me up at night.
Yeah. And in your first Facebook post that you shared, sharing your story and that you were positive, you wrote about a moment that you prepared to say your goodbyes to your fiance and your mom. And I mean, I can't imagine that, but how was it to feel the need to do that, to feel like this might be the lowest point, this might be the end in a life that people assume has so much more to go?
You know, it's hard to go back to that moment because I just love life and I feel like there's so much more that I want to do. And I think reflecting back now, it gives me a lot more empathy for other people who are in those moments because it's sad and it's scary, especially being there alone and not being able to really touch anyone and touch the people I love and tell them in person that I love them. You know, I kept getting worse and I kept thinking this, I can only get worse for so long. And I was, you know, hooked up to heart monitors. And when I went into the hospital, I was really dehydrated and had super low blood pressure. And so it's not that I wasn't hopeful that I would get better, but my body wasn't getting better and it was causing me to worry.
Did you have that same amount of worry when you first had to go back to the ER to be admitted? Did you think this could be the last time I see this person?
No, I didn't at that moment because honestly, I was so out of it. You know, I couldn't even get myself out of the car. I was put into a wheelchair and then it's almost like I hardly remember even that those first, you know, that first night in the hospital. So I was so out of it. I wasn't even really thinking about anything. I was mostly sleeping.
In the moments when you were awake and thinking and concerned and noticing how your body was feeling, in what ways did you try to cope with the pain? Did you find activities or thoughts or things that kind of helped you?
So I had a meditation app that I used. And that helped a little bit just to really help me focus on breathing and not panicking. I completely stopped listening to the news and went off social media and really tried to not look at anything about COVID-19 just because there's so much bad news and it would just cause more anxiety. And then I watched the movie Julie and Julia about 4 or 5 times when I was in the hospital, because I was hoping it would spark a desire to eat, because that was a big issue, is I just did not have an appetite and I only wanted to eat sugary things. And, you know, it didn't work, but it's a great movie. And now I know all the lines.
Yeah, it'll be a movie forever changed for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Were you able to FaceTime with your family, friends? Did you have the energy to?
No, and I did a little bit. But again, I was so out of it, you know, most of the time and, you know, just kind of dealing with my own demons, it was hard. And I know that, you know, I wasn't looking very good and, you know, just in that I looked really sick and weak and, you know, I didn't want to scare my friends and family any more than they already were. So, you know, mostly texting.
So what was the turning point where the doctors were telling you like, okay, it looks like you can be discharged pretty soon?
Yeah. So I got several chest x-rays when I was there because of course I had the pneumonia in my lungs. And the last morning, they did a final chest x-ray and it wasn't 100%, but it was well enough where they thought, you know, maybe I'm over the hump. And so they sent me home with some breathing exercises and you know, with not necessarily medication besides some cough medicine, but, you know, just the doctor's orders to take it easy and stay hydrated.
So you've been out of the hospital and are now technically cleared of that isolation period post-hospital. You know, you can leave your home, but how has your body felt since being released?
So just now I'm starting to feel a little bit back to normal, you know, in my body. I'm still tired. I still take a nap every day, which I had never done before. And now it kind of there's a still lingering feeling in my chest. And I kind of compare it to like going to a bonfire and maybe inhaling too much smoke and feeling it the next day, that kind of crackly, achy feeling in your chest. That's kind of how it feels. And some days are better than others.
So what concerns you the most being a survivor of COVID-19, but not really having any concrete answers?
I'm terrified of infecting someone else. You know, the thing that has been the most frustrating about having COVID is just how nobody knows anything. And people you expect to have the answers, like doctors, like health, public health officials, there's so much that they don't know. And so, you know, I've been cleared. They say that I'm not contagious, but now that I have a little bit of doubt in my mind, and I'm, you know, just mentally a little bit anxious about that risk, because of course the last thing I want to do is hurt anyone.
Why did you decide to share your story first initially online through your Facebook and now with us?
Yeah, well, so I wrote this Facebook post, and originally, you know, I had just written it to friends, and then, you know, my mom asked if she could share it on her Facebook page. So, you know, you do what your mom wants. So I made it public, and all of a sudden, you know, it just kind of blew up, and I think it's been shared like over 30,000 times now. And it's kind of shocking. But when I wrote it, you know, I had just gotten home, and, or, you know, that week, and I still was feeling so horrible. I was sleeping most of the day, and I felt so lonely. And, you know, I didn't really know anyone else who had the same kind of symptoms or who had had it quite as bad as I had gotten it, or who had been in the hospital. And so, you know, I think thinking about it now, I wanted to tell all my friends that this happened to me. But also I wanted to share my story because I wanted others to know that they weren't alone, that there was someone out there who had had, you know, a similar experience. And I kind of wanted to put myself out there. And that actually since has really helped, I think, in my recovery, helped me feel less alone, less isolated, which is, you know, why I made a website so that people could kind of gather there. And I've spent a lot of time over the last couple of weeks responding to messages through Messenger, through the blog, just with people who are in the hospital, who are at home recovering and just feeling scared. And I feel scared too.
Have they been asking you any common questions that, you know, we haven't already touched upon in our conversation? Because I'm, like you said, there's so much unknown. And even as you are recovering and released, you don't know if you're immune. You don't know what life is going to look like going forward necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people ask about the medications I received in the hospital. People are asking about, in general, how I'm doing. I think it helps people to know that there are people who get COVID who go to the hospital and recover and survive. And so, you know, people just generally checking in on me. And then, you know, just kind of getting a sense of my timeline and when they can expect to feel better. And from my own kind of messaging with people, a lot of folks are saying, you know, it's about taking them about 7 weeks to really feel like themselves again. And I'm not there yet, but I plan to have a little party by myself here in my house when that moment comes.
Well, and your story is helping others, but I think what you've seen, what a lot of people are seeing, is that it affects everyone differently. How important is that point to hit home, that this is your version, you know, of COVID. It might not be exactly the same.
Oh, for sure. I mean, everybody's different, but there are some things that there seem to be trends in my little corner of the world with the folks I've talked with, and, you know, small things like not being able to taste anything, to just kind of a shared understanding of this kind of ongoing feeling in your chest several weeks later, and just kind of the lingering anxiety that, you know, nobody wants to hurt anybody, and just having so many people be so afraid of us and whether we're contagious or not.
Yeah. How are you trying to take care of yourself now in post-recovery?
Yeah. Everyone tells me I need to keep drinking water. So I'm trying to do that and stay hydrated. I'm a little bit tired of hearing that, actually. and, you know, I like to walk my dogs around the block, you know, just that kind of basic recentering stuff that I think can help everyone. But, you know, so many people have reached out to me with such kind things to say and kind of hopes for my recovery. And that has helped me. And, you know, I had someone, kind of an acquaintance friend from my alma mater, McAllister College, reach out to me, and who's an art therapist. And so I've been doing some art therapy sessions over video, and that has been really helpful just to kind of regroup after just feeling like I'm on another planet for the last 6 weeks or whatever.
So what's your call to action for everyone listening now and moving forward as many places across the US and around the world continue with extensions for safer at home orders?
I've thought a lot about this, and, you know, this is why I called my website Better by Each Other, because I think this whole situation with COVID has made me realize how connected we are and how much we can impact each other, and how we can just do a little bit better by each other. And so maybe that's, you know, wearing a mask, even though it's uncomfortable and it's not perfect, or maybe that's, you know, wearing gloves, or not going to the grocery store today and just eating that macaroni that you have in your pantry instead. Those little things, they have a ripple effect. And I think the more we can do better by each other, the better off we're going to be during this pandemic and the stronger communities we're going to have.
Since you've been home and having this experience, do you think that people aren't taking it as seriously as it should be warranted? Because they maybe don't have the connection, they don't know someone who's had it, and all they're seeing is the news of the worst of it, New York or other things, and it's numbers, it's not connection.
Yeah, I think with anything, hearing personal stories helps people understand things in a new way, which, you know, from that Facebook post that I had, I've been contacted by a lot of different news organizations to do an interview, and I haven't really wanted to, just because I don't necessarily want to be the face of COVID in Wisconsin. But, you know, I chose to do this one because I'm a public radio nerd, and also because I think it is important for people to hear that someone actually has experienced COVID right down the street from them in Stallus. And I think, you know, that stories are what connect people to each other, and I think make it more real for people. And, you know, a little bit, I'm hoping that's what my kind of opening up about my experience will do.
You mentioned Better by Each Other, which is the name of your website and how people have been reaching you. So with that regard, going through these messages you're receiving, how far do they extend? And what have been some of the most impactful or memorable things that have stuck out to you?
You know, the thing that amazes me is how this Facebook post and the website are just getting out to people kind of all over the world. And it's kind of amazing how we're having, in some ways, this very shared experience. And while, you know, everybody's different, there are some similar kind of trends in the people who are messaging me about their recovery, about their fears, about their anxieties. So I've been trying to kind of take what I hear and put these in blog posts, just as a way for people who are recovering from home or who are in the hospital can just go there and know that other people have had some of their experiences, and to know that they're not alone in this crazy experience that they're having.
Well, Danielle Nelson, I'm sure all these people in Tenfold are very grateful for you sharing your experience and continuing to help others through it, recovery and beyond. And I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us. It means a lot.
Thank you. And thanks to everyone who's reached out to me and has really helped with my recovery as well.
Danielle Nelson is a COVID-19 survivor who lives in West Allis. We spoke back in May. You can find out more and a link to her website, Better by Each Other, at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air is next.